Good morning. I'm your host, Claudia Shambaugh, welcoming you to the August 30th, 2022 edition of Ask a Leader. Today, my guests include Alex Armlovich, Senior Housing Policy Analyst at the Niskanen Center. We'll weigh in on how empty nesters are trapped in the single-family huts and how young owners are shut out. The barriers toward solving this are as persistent as they are increasingly formidable. In the second segment, it's that time of the year for the annual UCI Mind Alzheimer's Conference. It's their 33rd, and it's a hybrid event for the first time. Megan Whitbrack, Associate Director of Education at UCI, will offer the highlights and the secret sauce blend of leading-edge topics and invited experts for all you prospective attendees this September 9th, 8 to 3:15 in the afternoon, in Irvine, the hotel, or in your own home. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the show. My first guest is Alex Armlovich, Senior Housing Policy Analyst at the Niskanen Center, to talk about what's baking into this American housing market. Boomers are empty nesters looking to downsize, while younger households are needing to let out their seams a bit, but the market is not allowing this exchange to take place. The market, or will he's going to talk about sort of the public side, the regulatory kind of aspects. The perverse trends are something I like to amplify all the way up to the 70,000 foot level, but I'm not getting too much traction. I'm hoping Alex can help me with why some of the journalists don't see it that way, don't capture that. We get to do this with him. His research translates urban economics into actionable, that's why we have him here, policy research on the creation of abundant and affordable housing of all kinds. Prior to his appointment at the Niskanen Center, Alex covered transportation, the Citizens Budget Commission of New York, at the Empire Center for Public Policy, was a state and local policy fellow at Manhattan Institute. He completed his Bachelor's of Arts in Economics and Political Science at the University of Rochester and his Master's in Public Policy and Social and Urban Policy from the Harvard Kennedy School. He comes to us today from somewhere else than Buffalo. Actually, I believe it's the LaGuardia, the fine LaGuardia stretches, right with us today. Welcome, Alex Armlovich, to Ask a Leader.
Claudia, thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you. So first, it's kind of it just started to put everybody right where we are, where you've been looking at it a lot and I've been ruminating a lot. If you can give us a snapshot of where we are with housing at this moment, with everybody sort of stuck, the elders downsizing and younger households expanding.
Claudia, thank you so much. Yes. So in general, it's basically a housing crisis that kind of has been emerging since 1980 in mostly coastal cities, metastasized across the country over the last couple of decades. And so we're now finally seeing median sale prices in the United States exceeding $300,000 countrywide for the first time. And, of course, in California, you guys have front row seats to and have been dealing with this for some time. I think in California, the median sale price now has exceeded $830,000. And that includes not just San Francisco and Los Angeles. That's statewide. You know, it includes, you know, the high desert. It includes rural areas, the Central Valley. So, really, California, I think, is in the front row of the housing crisis. But it's evidently spread nationwide.
Yes, and we can use as many as we can, some California examples in the service of community radio. But people are leaving California and, you know, leaving Orange County for that matter in Southern California. So the national aspect is really of interest to any community. So the demographics of home ownership, especially the single family home, if we could break down how we got from the small home post-World War II to the oversized huts that people are, I mean, it's kind of like a square footage not an arms race, but a square footage kind of thing, that American housing size is quite exceptional. And you, if anybody has ever left the country and visited any other country, our houses are oversized. Can you talk about that sort of historic aspect?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, demographically, you know, there's a lot of variation in the home ownership rate, especially by age. So people under 35, only around 40% of households under 35 own their homes. Everyone older than 35, at least a slight majority, and it increases with age. So, you know, 35 to 40-year-olds, you're seeing, you know, 65-ish percent home ownership rate. Then the very highest, 65 and older, just around 80% of households 65 and over own their own home. So it's a thing, you know, there's basically a life cycle aspect to that. And then, yeah, in terms of what you were talking about with, you know, unit size trends, basically we began suburbanizing the country after World War II. And there's a significant change in the type of houses that we were building. So as we stopped building so many apartment buildings and duplexes and triplexes in city centers and started building out the interstate highway system and new suburbs served by those interstate highways, we were seeing, you know, much larger suburban homes being built instead of the kind of more compact, small multifamily or even large apartment buildings that had tend to have smaller unit sizes. So, yeah, the average unit size in the United States is up probably about 1,000 square feet, you know, from around 1,400, 1,500 in the mid-70s to, 2,400, 2,500 now. Most recently peaked in 2015, has come down a little bit since then. But, there has been a little bit of return to multifamily building in the 2000s. Does that give you a good sense of the overall scheme of things?
It does. Well, it's not just in Southern California, but you can really see how oversized I know it was a big sort of two-parter there. And in preparing for this, an interesting point was made to me about why our housing allows for so much added square footage is that in other countries that have gone through, let's say, world wars, they had a deprivation of energy. They had to keep their energy costs down to heat up, or mostly for heating up. It's very expensive to maintain extra square footage. So they never really expanded their interiors. We've been able, I guess, to have much cheaper energy generally around the country, especially in, you know, hydroelectric and cheap natural gas and that kind of thing. So I just want to put that out there, that trend is, because we are exceptional in the size, and that size of housing is what is creating some of this affordable housing problem.
Sure, yeah, basically, until the 1973 oil crisis, it was kind of expected that there would be cheap energy as far as the eye could see, and that basically expanding cities extensively by lengthening and widening highways and building new suburbs farther and farther out from the city center, that basically would not, you know, be kind of have any policy problems. And I think that may have been, you know, proven over optimistic. Like you said, you know, cheap energy makes that a lot easier to do. You know, by contrast, I actually live in Queens, and you know, it's remarkable. This energy price shock has a very little direct impact, at least. If you live in a multifamily apartment and you don't own a car, you know, I take the train or ride an e-bike. I haven't bought gas in years. I don't even, I couldn't tell you what gas prices are. It's definitely true that in multifamily living, you can use a lot less energy. You're kind of less exposed to those energy price shocks, especially when you have the kind of mass transit and active transportation alternatives to using your car to get around. And then there's that other aspect of, if you're comparing the United States, say, to Europe, it is definitely true. The United States has been richer per capita than even Western Europe for most of the post-war period. And there's been some closure of that gap since the war, but it still remains the case that, you know, incomes per capita are higher, the ability to pay for larger units is here. But it does intersect with that American choice to suburbanize somewhat more than what you see in Western Europe.
And with what we're talking about, available, affordable housing stock, it's created a class, and I don't know what housing analysts refer to it as, but it's legacy housing. I mean, you talked about what percentage of the boomers versus those under 40, that if you don't have a house at a certain time, you're not in the market. And this includes some pretty good earners in households. You're out of the market if you don't have that legacy home.
That's absolutely right. I mean, there was basically like, you know, in the kind of 19th century tenement era, the United States did have something of an urban, you know, housing, like prices were high and crowding was really high. And we kind of, we built our way out of that in the late 19th and 20th century by, the invention of the elevator and the skyscraper let us build up. And first mass transit and then the highway let us build out. And so we kind of, you know, this explosion of urban growth by the late 60s, early 70s, we were building so fast, faster than population growth, that we were actually able even to, like, some city center neighborhoods were emptying out altogether, you know, because we were building faster in the suburbs than total population growth. But there was a backlash to that growth because, you know, highways, admittedly, the automobile has some genuine external costs that it imposes on the people that are near those highways. There was this backlash to growth that emerged in the, you know, from the early 60s building through the 1970s. By 1980, we had basically covered the country in growth controls that made it hard to build any kind of multifamily housing because it basically is to facilitate automobile use, because the denser a neighborhood is, the more unpleasant it can be to drive. And so if you want to facilitate a society based on driving, you know, density can be a little bit harder to drive. Now, density also makes it easier to run higher quality transit. You know, if you, let's say you have an hourly bus service, you know, you start adding more units per acre, you know, maybe you can run that bus economically every 30 minutes and then maybe every 15. Maybe upgrade that eventually to bus rapid transit. You know, if you keep growing from there, maybe you can do a tram or elevated rail. You know, eventually you get to Manhattan scale where you've got multiple local and express subways running on parallel avenues. Obviously, that's the most extreme. But transit is something that gets better the denser you are. But then the car, it gets, the more people are using the highways at the same time, the worse it is for everyone using it. So there's kind of, as we moved in the direction of the car, there was more of a, you know, resistance to density because it becomes more unpleasant with density. You know, whereas when we were a transit-based society, more people meant more transit and better transit, more frequent transit. And so, you know, there was less hostility to growth. So, you know, a bunch of these kind of like wider structural forces in society have kind of got us to this growth backlash and, you know, kind of, again, like I said, culminated in 1980. And now we're kind of ever since been clawing our way back.
And it's like you can date a city. When the automobile was introduced by, you know, how old the city is, and when the automobile is introduced, so a settled grid in Northeast versus what we have sprawling in Texas and in Southern California. Yeah, I'd like to just get a massive marketing to redirect the thinking about that density being such a boogeyman for what makes a companionable community living, you know? I mean, you're living in a very dense place, and you enjoy the heck out of it, as I'm going to put words in your mouth.
Yeah, no, absolutely. My office is in D.C. I continue living in Queens because I like it. D.C. is a wonderful city. I really love New York, you know? And it's just, you know, Queens, they call it the world's borough, you know, the melting pot. There's a neighborhood I live in is called Jackson Heights. It's probably the most diverse neighborhood in the United States. There's this great documentary on Netflix if you ever want to check out Jackson Heights. But truly just, you know, incredible food, really good. I have the ESMR and 7 trains all serving the neighborhood. But it's 4 times denser than San Francisco, even though I'm out in Queens. And, yeah, it's absolutely wonderful. There's all these things that come from people living close together in terms of the services, the amenities you can have. But, I mean, the most important thing is that you're scaling those public services with growth. You need to be growing bus service and growing the schools and growing all those kind of basics that come with that you need to keep quality of life high. Because, like, that's why, you know, my neighborhood is great to live in without a car because the bike options and the transit options are great. But, you know, if you don't scale those services and so you're relying on a car, but then it's hard to find parking and there's congestion, that leads to a growth backlash. So, you know, I really think, you know, scaling those public services with growth is just so important.
Well, and that, I mean, I know some of the little, the Niskanen sort of, there's some political philosophies in Manhattan Institute where you are. It's like there's a large libertarian sort of mindset about that. But I'm coming from leadership, vigorous leadership on the policy level to sort of show the community, to lead with the commitment to infrastructure, those what people call the nice things on social media, that I see that government has a real role in invigorating all these amenities that really perform for people once they get a taste of it. And I always see when infrastructure locally in Southern California, in Orange County and Irvine, the city of, when a fixed rail is suggested and, you know, there's a massive sort of hue and cry against that, with, you know, representing it as like a heavy gauged rail sort of presence in there. But it just, I'm of the mind that this is the making the case that real leadership in elected, appointed offices make decisions that really have a much better outcome for the public, but where it's a very diffident kind of a leadership pattern throughout. So I don't know I'm going to make you with the Manhattan and Niskanen sort of centers on mindsets, if you say, well, you're right, there is a leadership role here. We should be seeing more.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, like, you know, the Manhattan Institute probably trends a little bit more conservative than we do at Niskanen Center. You know, like, Niskanen kind of believes that we're like, free markets and social insurance are two great tastes that taste great together. You know, it's in other words, you know, healthy social insurance is both necessary and helpful to, you know, supporting a healthy society where free markets are going to, you know, be more functional and sustain social support over time. But, you know, even at Manhattan Institute, though, what makes such a difference there is that even, you know, older conservatives who work there, they take Metro North. They take the train to Grand Central that often.
Well, there you go.
They walk off Metro North. And so, like, even though it's conservative-leaning, people see functioning mass transit, and they're like, oh, like, of course. But if the Manhattan Institute were in Tampa, I don't think those views on transit would transcend. Does that make sense?
But put that person in Tampa, put them on a business trip in Queens, and they hop on one. They go, well, this would be nice. Actually, why don't we have this in Tampa? You know, for those of you who just joined us, my guest is Alex Armlovich. He's a senior housing policy analyst at the Niskanen Center. I'm sorry for mispronouncing the center, Niskanen Center. I'll get that right. I've read it many times. I've had one of your analysts on here years ago. So the other tension here is, it gets to the local leadership, and it's sort of how all the research that you've been doing, Alex, is that there's so many local ordinances that bake into the zoning, the land use patterns that prevent from a denser kind of affordable housing stock. And so there's that tension. Well, let's talk about how that there have been some zoning reconsiderations with accessory dwelling units where you can carve out at least one more unit out of folks, for those who don't know. But I worked on mapping for accessory unit potential in the Bay Area. I did that in the like early 80s. And so this has been around a long time, but it's the local government leadership and the pushback in all of these areas where people insist on, they're xenophobic about anything approaching any kind of density. So that's where all your research is detailing how all of those local regulations are baking into this sprawled, larger dwelling unit kind of pattern all over.
Yeah, absolutely. And ask me about, if you want to ask me one last question about transit later.
Transit.
I forgot to mention that.
That's fine. Please take that up.
Oh, yeah. But I was going to say, it's actually not New York City that is the model necessarily for California for scaling transit. It's what Seattle has. There's one city, I mean, one large city in the United States that actually grew transit ridership after the gas price crash of 2014. So you remember, like, gas prices were high in 2011. They started coming down in 2014.
Right.
There's one city that grew bus ridership in that time, and it's Seattle, in part because they rezoned to allow growth in their so-called transit villages in certain areas where they had the infrastructure for growth. But they also invested in bus service. And the rule of thumb they use is they wanted to get 3/4 of the population within a 10-minute walk of a bus that comes every 10 minutes. That's what a useful transit system looks like, is something that's fast and frequent. It has decent coverage. You know, versus if there's just one streetcar line all by itself, then the only reason you would ever use it is if you live and work on that streetcar line. If you need to go anywhere else, you got to use a car. So, like, that network approach, that rule of thumb that Seattle uses, that's how they were able to be the only U.S. city to grow bus ridership after 2014. It's very impressive. So, yeah, even New York City, we've been shedding bus riders like crazy.
Well, we're hearing about that, yeah. That's with the confounding factors of COVID and more people packing a few, weapons that are making there are deterrents there. But to the point, Seattle stepped up. There was leadership. There was vision. We are going to give people these transit options. And I get so frustrated, Alex, when I'm sitting in a parking lot and I'm looking on the interstate system in Orange County, in LA County, and there's a brand new transportation project. It's not fixed rail. It's more lanes. It's high occupancy vehicle. It's, fee for trips kinds of things. So it's sort of like simultaneously there's vision working, and then there's it's just an absurd anachronism that we're continuing to keep adding more lanes to more highways down here. Even though, I mean, we can't add new highways because of the Environmental Protection Agency non-attainment kind of air quality. And that part's baked in. But but we just keep adding more lanes where we could have put a fixed rail in one of those lanes, like what we see around this large system when I've seen it in Seattle.
Yeah, I mean, it's so important. Like, if you combine your land use regulations with that infrastructure investment, you could do incredible things. You know, like, Los Angeles has run into trouble where, you know, ridership is disappointed on the rail system they've built out. You know, it's Measure M, right?
That's the one. Yeah.
Tens of billions of dollars. But, you know, and then, like, when ridership disappoints, even pre-COVID, you know, you look at the Expo line in West LA, for example, is the one I always use it, you know, they've got houses on, you know, they've got single family homes on large lots right next to the Expo line. And it's like, when you build the transit, and then you have to let people live next to it. Because if you don't let people live near the train, it's a lot harder to use it.
Well, and that's what the state legislature in California was trying to accomplish, and what met great resistance, the Senate Bill 10, which was, I mean, it's taken effect fine. It was signed in, it's taken effect January of this year, but that was to address creating more density. I think there's merit, and you can tell us if there is not merit, Alex's, that there was no guarantee the dense housing adjacent to those sort of transportation nodes, was that going to be an affordable stock, or is it just going to be more deluxe housing? So that's where I keep, there's that tension of, there's regulation that bakes into these land use sorts of aspect, but the market's saying, no, we really want deluxe units here next to the metro.
Yeah, I mean, that's like, it varied. There were earlier bills like SB 827, SB 50 that were kind of a statewide housing next to transit. Those did not pass, and so, you know, California has been doing more kind of one bill at a time, just kind of chipping away at the problem. But, I mean, that's what's interesting about California is there's been a slow-motion revolution in land use, and I believe they're starting to turn the aircraft carrier. So, you know, it's like, you know, and yes, why did California start? It's like, well, California's median sale price is $830,000, or now exceeding that. That's why it started in California. I think finally people hit a level that they're like, we need to do something. We're getting to the point where even the middle class, you know, can't afford to stay in California. And so, like, you know, that's why I advocate for an all of the above. It's like, it's nice for the state to deploy its capital budget to, you know, get inclusionary units, mixed income housing in there. But, like, even, you know, middle-class units now, we've got such a backlog that there's even these somewhat higher-end units. We need all of them. You know, the higher-end and the subsidized, all the way down to very low income. It's kind of the whole gamut in California is backlog.
And, yeah, everybody's stuck. Well, I think we've laid out the complexities and the sort of interacting factors of this kind of expectation for what a house looks like and feels like, and the kinds of local regulating drivers here for that persist in this. But I want to see if we can wrap up with I always want more journals to talk about. And I've approached the state senator, Scott Wiener. I had a chance to meet him at a political convention. And and he's the one that sponsored many of these local government overrides for more dense housing around those transportation nodes. And I said, well, you know, what are we going to do? And this is what I want to run past you, Alex, is this massive trend of more and more housing stock being owned by fewer and fewer owners. And I'm going to make a quick little off-ramp with that. The Airbnb, Brian Chesky, the Airbnb CEO, he's downplaying the impact of the Airbnb sort of model that is consolidating the ownership and bidding up the price of the housing stock, where Airbnb homes are or where the Airbnb employees are living. But we have increasing housing stock owned by, let's say, there's equity portfolios and others that they're flipping them to rent them out. They're not going to be occupied by homeowners. So I don't know, why do you think that this isn't getting coverage, this very pernicious trend that's causing that with fewer and fewer people owning this stock, it's creating a problem with a larger and larger share of the household budget being expended only on housing? So why do you think it's not really being highlighted like that? Because when I approached Scott Wiener about this, Senator Scott Wiener, he just looked at me and he said, well, that's complicated. So I thought, oh, great, there is no leadership with this freight train, this engine of racing toward this. Really, it's an unwieldy kind of trend. In it's not just home ownership, it's just dwelling is becoming more and more expensive. So why do you think we're not getting that highlighted more, that 70,000-foot level analysis?
Yeah, and I would say, at a very high level, so the final user cost of housing is kind of determined by supply and demand, no matter who owns it. So even if it's built to rent, but who owns it determines where windfall gains go if you keep tight housing market in place. Does that make sense? So it's like, if you change the corporate form of ownership, the total number of units available is still, it's like they go from being homeowner units to renter units. And it means that future appreciation will go to whoever holds it, but that the final kind of user cost is a function of the total number of homes available. Now, so like how much that will increase inequality will depend on how much we allow house prices to keep spiraling. And so in other words, if we're able to start moderating house price growth by more total supply, then it shouldn't be a huge concern. But if prices keep going up while it's also being more concentrated, then it's like user costs will go up and the windfall will, be more and more concentrated. But I would also say part of the build-to-rent phenomenon is that we tightened lending standards after the Great Recession. And so first-time home buyers, there's still support for them. There's still state-level programs and there's FHA lending, available. But kind of non-FHA loans for entry-level buyers are a lot tighter than they used to be. So where starter homes are allowed, like we talked earlier, that minimum lot sizes basically kind of outlaw small, what we call starter homes, but also starter homes are useful for boomers who want to downsize.
Right, right.
Those now, to the extent where they are legal, those are more often built to rent than they used to be, because you're seeing that those tighter lending standards for new borrowers. So, is that a fair overview, or feel free to drill in on more aspects of
Well, we're going to have to start winding this all the way down, but I'm pretty alarmed by the trend. And I, when financial analysts are helping people with their budgets, and I think they underestimate how much every household is paying for housing costs. So I'm concerned.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And you put an if in your expression of if this can be sort of reversed, and that if is doing a lot of work there, Alex. So I'm concerned that the consolidation is really concentrating, and it's got momentum. And I think it's sort of I don't know if the Freakonomics people talk about that with you too. Do you get consoled by the Freakonomics folks?
Oh, I mean, I would say I'm friendly with that
okay.
group overall. I know them on Twitter. But
speaking
I
of freaking,
person.
Yeah.
Living in Dubner. Yeah.
Right. So that was a little bit quirky of me. But there are,
no,
I just want to put out, though, that these trends really have a whole lot of momentum. And for people to think about, I guess we have elections, and elections are putting the pressure on people to show leadership for a more workable settlement pattern. I'm just, as an urban planner by training, I just want to say that it's the settlement pattern that we're missing out on, that, and it's getting, I think, more and more bleak. But maybe I'll just let you wrap the whole interview with, it's not necessarily that bleak, or no, everybody needs to step up and provide leadership and put pressure on leadership to reconsider our settlement patterns.
I was going to say, I definitely agree that, more compact and mixed uses nearby allows you to consume less energy, drive less, while still having the option to use a car. It's just you have the ability to use a car, but you're not required, because you've got, a bike option and you've got a bus option. And in more built-up areas, you've got a rail option. And so, like, that's changing those overall settlement patterns, I think that's a great point. As an urban planner, you know, there are a lot of idealistic young urban planners who, they're like, when I, you know, they go to planning school and they're like, oh, I want to become a planner because I want to discipline the market and curb excess sprawl because capitalism causes sprawl. And then, you know, they get into their planning job, and their actual planning boss is like, look, you have to mandate automobile parking near the subway. I don't know why, I just do it. So, like, the kind of real world planning has, you know, gone very far from what the ideal in planning school kind of looks like. And you're right that we need to change that in the long run. Now, on the increasing concentration of ownership, in terms of what you're seeing with, you know, build to rent or the purchase of single family homes for rental purposes, that if you go to Houston or Dallas, people aren't talking about it. Because it's just kind of not,
it's not their language.
Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
It's not their language. Well, that thought there in Texas, and we've got to go.
Yeah, just to close on that, is just that when housing is abundant and a typical, like a middle-class household can buy a townhouse for $280,000, you don't hear anyone talking about Blackstone. Because it just doesn't matter that much if if you rent cheaply from Blackstone or you buy your own house for, well, under $300,000, you know, it's kind of, there's not an ongoing windfall of house price gains to argue over, because people, you know, housing is just kind of provided and abundant and accessible. It's like, that's kind of the world that we want to get to, but to the extent we're not in that world, then fights over who gets the gains become more important.
So, Alex, let's have you back at a later date where you see a real breakthrough case study that we can put up there, amplify as a real model that's reversing these trends, that everybody can hear me wringing my hand out very publicly. I know you'll be keeping your eye out for that. So let's have you do that. So thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate this opportunity to cover it this way with you.
Claudia, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. My guest was Alex Arnovich, Senior Housing Policy Analyst at the Niskanen Center. We'll be right back with Megan Whitbracht. She's going to cover the 33rd Annual UCI Mind Alzheimer's Conference on our calendars September 9th this year. Be right back. Don't go away. Welcome back to the show. It's the time for the annual UCI Mind Alzheimer's Conference. It's their 33rd. It's a hybrid event this year. And we'll talk about all those kinds of logistics. My next guest to cover this is Megan Whitbracht.
That's correct.
Whitbracht. And she's Associate Director of Education at UCI, here to offer the highlights and the secret sauce blend of leading edge topics and invited experts for all you prospective attendees this September 9th. It's 8 a.m. to 3:15 p.m. either at the Irvine Hotel or in the privacy of your own home. Dr. Whitbracht is responsible for managing the regulatory activities for studies conducted at UCI Mind. She directs UCI Mind outreach, recruitment, and education programs throughout Orange County. It's a huge enterprise. Prior to her many projects and programs at UCI Mind, Dr. Whitbracht was a quality assurance director at the Olive Oil Factory, a graduate student researcher at the United States Department of Agriculture Western Human Nutrition Research Center, senior lab technician at Minor Family Winery, among other tasks and jobs and all that she's had. She completed her Bachelor of Science in Cell Biology and her advanced degrees at UC Davis. She joins me in studio. Welcome to Ask a Leader, Megan Whitbracht.
Thank you for having me, Claudia.
Thank you so much. So let's start with the theme for the 33rd annual Dementia Across the Lifespan. What you're trying to do with that, because there's always a theme for the conference, but this one's a kind of its own expansive work you're doing.
Yes, that's right. So this year we're tackling dementia from different parts of someone's lifespan. So we're looking at from people in their early 30s to late in their 80s, 90s, 10th decade of life. And what we're doing is we're not only looking at Alzheimer's disease, but we're also looking at other forms of dementia, frontal temporal dementias. We're looking at a newly kind of described dementia called late We're also
late. Okay, is that an acronym?
It is.
L-A-T standing for.
That's right.
When you can take an opportunity to break down some of those others, sort of life, the age spans of this different kinds of presentation of dementia.
Yeah, so we're starting in the morning with Dr. Elizabeth Head, who's a professor here at UC Irvine, and she's going to talk about Alzheimer's disease in people with Down syndrome. People with Down syndrome are at a significantly greater risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. And so, yeah, she's going to talk about sort of current research being done in people with Down syndrome and Alzheimer's disease. And then we're going to move into...
Can we just wait one moment, though? That there is this one pair, that one pair of genes that is present with a Down syndrome individual that is also that memory deficiency in an Alzheimer's patient. Is it that one number 17 pairing or 12? I can't remember. But there is a real straight line there.
They carry an extra copy. They tend to carry an extra copy of the APP gene.
Okay. And I thought there was a gene. There was a pair that where that is. But it's the
We'll have to.
So go ahead back to what she's going to.
Yeah, she's going to talk about current treatments for people with Down syndrome and Alzheimer's disease. She's going to talk about current research being done in that population.
And in that population, they're coming in with observational studies, because I don't remember when I had been spending more time around UCI Mind that they tended to be more geriatric patients. So this is a slightly more expanded demographic that are age groups there.
Right. So what Dr. Head and others have found is that people with Down syndrome are having the pathological features of Alzheimer's disease very early in life. It's accumulating much earlier in life than sort of sporadic forms of Alzheimer's disease.
Okay, that's Dr. Head.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Jessica Langbaum.
Right, so she's coming in to talk about autosomal dominant Alzheimer's disease, which is the sort of purely genetic form of Alzheimer's disease. Very rare, but really interesting research being done in that area.
How does that present then?
Right. Good question. So these are people that if they receive one copy of a gene, they're almost 100% guaranteed they'll get the disease. They tend to get the disease in their as early as their 30s, but typically in their 40s and 50s. The disease progresses very quickly.
Okay. And then Dr. Catherine Pawson?
Right.
And that's an interesting number of enterprises that she's bringing in that's really adapted well, suitable for situations like staying in place.
Right. So what's really cool about this conference is that there's an emphasis on care, caregiving, care programs. And sort of in the middle of our research-focused talks, we have these two dementia care programs, one from UCSF and one from UCLA. They've both been very successful. And so we're going to have two of the researchers who sort of created the program and have published on the program talk about them. And the first is Catherine Pawson, and the second is Dr. Lee Jennings.
Okay. So I want for people, while we're listening to the roster of speakers, when I was talking about the secret sauce, it's what I always bring to the Alzheimer's conference interviews I do every year. I think I missed last year. But it's uncanny how the content, it's leading edge, and it's accessible to lay audiences like yours truly, and it's leading edge and speaking to the research attendees, the people that are really deeply involved in this, in the very highly technical sense. So I know Dr. Josh Grill works at this, but it's an uncanny kind of a presentation that makes that room. Virtually it's going to be a little bit different because I'll be doing this virtually. So I won't be in that room where there's all these people that are, you know, and there's an interaction with each other, but how those speakers can reach everybody is phenomenal, Megan.
Right. He does a remarkable job of curating the perfect group of speakers who can speak to both a lay audience and that professional audience. We offer CEUs, to nurses, psychologists, but he also gets this group of speakers who are really good at talking to lay audiences, caregivers, people who are interested in Alzheimer's disease, people that don't do research or aren't clinicians, but just interested in learning more about Alzheimer's disease and other dementias.
So that's what's going on as we're listing all of these speakers. So there is then next Peter Lubienkov.
Yes, that's right. That's a tough name. But Lubienkov?
Lubienkov, okay.
You probably said it better than I did.
No.
So he's actually going to talk about a group of really interesting types of dementia, frontal temporal dementias. They have an interesting presentation, and there's not as much known about them. So he's going to talk about current treatment updates for what we call FTD, frontal temporal dementia.
And it's important with frontal temporal that people might think it's Alzheimer's, but it is not. And it's another kind of dementia. I mean, I hope nobody, you're hearing, you're very technical and you're hearing me slaughter this. But it's like what a person might be thinking they're dealing with Alzheimer's, but there are very particular features of the frontal temporal. And you won't, you can confirm it with how the disease is processing in the, I'll say the patient, because it's a medical kind of a discussion, mm-hmm. but the individual, but it can be known before there is an autopsy done. It's, you can confirm it by the way it's presenting with that patient and the type of decline.
Sure.
The functioning of that individual and other features. You can maybe help me distinguish between that and Alzheimer's.
Right. I think the clinical presentation is quite different than Alzheimer's disease. I'm not an expert, so I'm interested to hear what Peter's going to talk about. But I do know the clinical presentation is different. And I'm not sure what biomarker tests are available for FTD dementias. It has a different pathology. So, yeah, I'm just not sure. We'll have to see.
And for family members surviving, because everybody dies in these. But for family members surviving, it's important to confirm which kind of dementia, so that they know what is a possibility of their inheriting some of those genes, and that may be where they themselves would have that process.
Sure. So classically, with Alzheimer's disease, we've only ever been able to provide a definitive diagnosis at autopsy. Things are changing now. There are biomarker tests, specifically PET scans and
spinal fluid.
That's right. Yep.
And blood drawing, in part. Not definitively, but partly.
Right. So blood tests are developing. We'll probably have a few in the next few years that may be able to give us the same information that doing a PET scan or drawing CSF can.
Okay.
We're not quite there yet, but we're hoping.
So I went on a huge off-ramp with that, but I want to sort of bring why it's so interesting to hear these talks so that you can sort of understand, you know, what's going on and the distinctions and what is known and why it's important to know this.
Mm-hmm.
So on to Dr. Sajjadi, he's right here.
Right. Ahmad Sajjadi is fantastic. He's a neurologist here at UC Irvine. He specializes in tauopathies or uncommon dementias. Those are two different things. But in particular, he does a lot of primary progressive aphasia. That's a form of dementia. He's going to be talking to us today about a newly described form of dementia called late.
I'm going to go over some of the logistics so people can know that you can go to the UCI Mind website and they will have the conference pulled up there. It will be, as I said, September 9th from 8 in the morning. It will conclude at 3:15, so you can sign up either to go to the Irvine Marriott Hotel on Von Karman here in Irvine. You can otherwise register as a virtual attendee. That means you're not going to be sitting side by side with the best and the brightest and the active activist and astute kinds of lay people that are always contributing as much as. So how about a breakdown of what the LATE acronym stands for?
Sure.
Megan, please.
It's limbic, predominant, age-related, TDP-43 encephalopathy.
Okay. So, is there a nice shorthand for what that means?
Yes. So I think it is describing a disease. TDP 43 is the type of protein that's out of whack in, that's probably not the best scientific term, but is not folding, not doing what it's supposed to in the brain, that's causing this form of dementia. It typically starts later in life. There's not a lot known about it. So essentially,
this is going to be breaking news at the conference about that.
Relatively, yeah. Okay. I hate to make declarative statements, but there aren't many researchers studying it.
Okay.
Dr. Sajati is one of those, and he's published data on this form of dementia. It typically strikes later in life, 80s and 90s, and it's hard to distinguish between Alzheimer's disease. It has a different pathology, so it looks different in the brain. But he's trying to figure out, how is it different than Alzheimer's disease? Clinically, how does it present differently?
Right, right. And he'll be able to, that's a work in progress, but he'll be able to relay a little of findings so
absolutely
people can be distinguishing that. So it is important to know, because of how there is a performance, there's different kinds of memories, there's different memory capacity and all that. So it's important that these, and eventually the general public is going to understand it's not just dementia, it's different kinds, and they'll know how to respond. And I'm going to go off on one little off ramp here, mm-hmm. even though we're out of time. Mm-hmm. But I recently met an old friend who's the widow of an Alzheimer's patient. He was enrolled here, and she was laying really hard on an octogenarian friend of ours. And she said, "Don't you remember that? Don't you remember?" And I thought, my gosh, this person, I thought she learned about there's memory loss in elders. And I thought, you know, so this is why I'm saying that the value of this conference, I'm bringing us back now, mm-hmm. is that there are nuances that the lay people can take from this conference to understand, appreciate, interact, and assist people whose memories are failing them, who are having different sorts of dementia processing in them.
That's right. So we'll have one more talk after Dr. Sajati's. That's Dr. Vamuri. She's going to talk about resilience and resistance to cognitive decline. And then we're going to end with this fantastic caregiver panel. So we're going to have caregivers for each of the different types of dementia that we're going to be talking about earlier in the day. And we're going to have them talk about their experience that I think kind of goes back to what you were talking about your friend, and how hopefully the lay audience gets some sort of understanding, if they don't already have it, of what people caring for someone with these different types of dementia goes through.
And this is institutionalized at this conference. It's a remarkable panel to see. It's mild cognitive impairment, but it's still, the markers are present, with the one spouse talking about it and the other spouse talking about working through and around with all that. So
sure. We're only going to have caregivers.
Only
the caregivers.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, and so, okay. Previously, they were interacting, the couples. So, okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for making sure I understood that. So we've gone over the logistics. People can sign up at UCI Mind for the registration details. And I just want to thank you. That was all the time we were able to give you, Megan Woodbrack. Thank you for coming all the way to the studio and bringing this marvel of a conference for people to consider joining again this year.
Yeah, thank you, Claudia. It was a pleasure talking to you and your audience. Absolutely. I'd love to come back.
Okay, good. Well, we will do that. So that was Megan Woodbrack. She's Associate Director of Education at UCI. With the 33rd Annual UCI Mind Alzheimer's Conference, September 9th in the morning into the mid-afternoon. That's my wrap. Next week, we're going to Ukraine with Andriy Strehalyuk. He's a democratic activist, a tech entrepreneur, now assisting the military in Ukraine. It's going to be a model of what democratic activism reflexes are like and what he's doing in the middle of all that. So it'll be remarkable. Talk with you next week. Thank you, everyone, for listening.